Well, Kufar, Akbar, everybody, it is Radio Free Kafiristan, a radio program dedicated to proclaiming the truth with the ideology. Let me get my mic over here. But with the ideology of Islam teaches over the next hour, God willing, we will discuss the facts about the religion of Islam, its origins, its sources, its practices, its root system, and the fruit it bears. To this end, thus go I, shalom, peace and blessings. This is your host, once again, Eric Zekifer, coming to you live from the cavernous depths of the Kafir Cave in Dar al-Harb, Kafir Stand. I am again joined and directed by the Red of the Right, showing up at the last second, the birthday girl, Cal Fritzy. Happy birthday, Cal. I'd ask how old you are, but that's not polite. I do that often, too. I'm not the politest guy, but I'm not going to ask how old you. You don't look a day over 23. How's that? Yes, there you go, right there in the chat. Oh, to be 23 again. I'd be a lot dumber if I was 23 again. Just, you know, I think back when I was 23, and I'm thinking, you know what? Kafir, you just didn't know a lot back then. Anyway, okay, we are live here every Sunday at 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 4 p.m. Central Standard Time. That would be Chicago time. I am told in Nigeria it is 10 o'clock, not 11 o'clock. And in the center of the universe, that makes it midnight. I am live casting on Facebook. I'm live casting on the Global Patriot Radio network link right here. And over here on my personal Facebook account, and I see you there. Nadir, thank you for coming. If you call into the call-in number, I have it listed, I believe, at the beginning of the show notes there. The number is, if you want to call in, here it is, Nadir. It's area code 319-527-6706. Let me say it again, area code 319-527-6706. Remember, a Kafir is someone who does not heed the beliefs and prescriptions held by the religion of Islam. That comes right off of a definition provided by the internet and an Islamic website. So if you differ with me, please don't call in and say, well, you're not. I just don't want to get into the discussion. I might even change my name. I don't know. Maybe we could pop something in the chat room that would be semi-interesting. Eric, I don't know. You guys get creative, more creative than I am. Remember, Dar al-Harb is the house of war. That is the areas in this world that are not governed or ruled by Sharia law, unlike Pakistan, Afghanistan, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, etc. Stan, all of those are Dar al-Islam, which is supposed to be peace until there's no further resistance or questioning of Islam. And that is according to Reliance of the Traveler, which is the jurisprudence manual for Sharia Islamia. Again, here again, the call-in number is area code 319-527-6706. We're going to be doing a couple things today. I'm going to start off with the monologue. And then we're going to be talking about those anachronisms that we find in the Quran, the many anachronisms that we find. And then we'll be going to Nadir's phone call. That'll probably be about 4:30 Chicago time, 5:30 New York time or Florida time, depending on where you're in Florida. There's some panhandle. We learned during the 2000 election that the panhandle is actually an hour behind the majority of Florida. And they called the election for Al Gore, of all people. Okay, I'm showing my age. All right, so what do I want to talk about in my monologue this week? Well, I had an interesting week. Of course, as you all know, I'm James White. I don't know if you guys ever heard of James White. He has a radio show. It's called Alpha of the Dividing Line. It's on his channel, Alpha and Omega Ministries. And he's always talking about his Twitter experiences for the week. And, you know, sometimes it's interesting. Sometimes it's boring as all get out. But sometimes it's really interesting in what happens. And I had a real interesting week this week. And, Kel, I forgot to thank you for filling in for me last week. I did get to listen to the show on podcast with where Tim called in and how you guys were discussing Kavanaugh and
Roe v. Wade, and it was just a great show, and I appreciate you doing that. You went a long time, if I remember. I think 2 hours. I can't imagine doing 2 hours on this show, unless, of course, somebody calls in and does the majority of talking for me. But this past week, I was dealing with an individual by the name of Ijaz Ahmad, and we were discussing carbon-14 dating of the Quran. Now, I didn't realize this, but this is a popular guy. I didn't know this. He's in charge of the Islamic Debate Initiative, and he's engaged with Jay Smith. So this guy is a smart guy. He's a fairly decent apologist, but just let me discuss what would happen. We were talking about, let's see, he has his own blog, he's debated Jay Smith, he didn't really know I really didn't know who he was until I was listening on the way back. Queen and I went down to Mississippi this past week. We went down the Natchez Trace, we went over to Vicksburg, a Civil War battlefield, and then we went down to New Orleans. And where did we go from there? It seems like we went over to Biloxi, Mississippi, and then we came up. And I tell you, it took 12 hours for what was normally supposed to be a much shorter drive than that. And that was just to get to where we were supposed to be for the night. I mean, that wasn't getting back to clear back to Darul Harb back up here in Kafiristan. And that was just that night. By the time we got to the hotel, I was I was so mad because it just stop and go. Because everybody's trying to get out of the way of the hurricane. Okay. Anyway, as I was listening to Jay, I tried to have this discussion with this guy because I was listening on my bat phone. And they were having a debate or discussion or something. I noticed a lot of the same things he was saying to Jay, and the way that he was saying it was the way that he approaches it on Facebook. Now, we were in a discussion over radiometric dating. Yeah, I know. It's real exciting stuff. Radiometric dating, specifically carbon-14 dating of the Birmingham and the Sana manuscripts and the results of those dates. Now, if you look at the C14 dating, carbon-14 dating, and if you don't know how it works, it's really not that hard to understand. Carbon-14 is an unstable isotope. It decays. And when it decays into a daughter element. And there's a certain amount of time where you can get half of those C14 isotopes to decay into the daughter element. I think it's nitrogen-14, back to nitrogen-14, maybe down to C12. I don't know. But parent-daughter isotopes. And in 5,730 years, you will have half of those isotopes decay back to the parent isotopes decay back to the daughter isotopes, which means if you start with 1,000 in 5,730 years, you'll have 500. Another 5,730 years, you'll have 250. Another 5,730 years, you'll have 125. That's why they call it a half-life. Well, they use this process to date organic material. Anything that has been ingested by animals or absorbs carbon-14 through the atmosphere, namely plants, and then the animals who eat them, they can pretty much tell how old that item is by the number of the ratio of parent and daughter elements in it. I know this is best described using charts and stuff like that, but the bottom line is that you can tell how old something is by the amount of C14 it has in it versus the daughter elements. Well, the Sana manuscript, by using accelerator mass spectrometry, which is a C14 method, dates back to 2388 AD. Now, that's 200 years before Muhammad was born. It's the earliest date that we began with in the discussion. But the discussion all stemmed from a comment I made when we were discussing about the Quran predates the Quran. Now, this sent everything and everybody into tizzy and me getting called all kinds of nasty little things. But anyway, I used these dates as a demonstration of a point that I was making. But then what he does is he turns around, Hijaz, turns around and cites this big, long 25-page Islamic awareness article. You know, I scanned through it because mostly it was just background stuff and it didn't really have to do with the particular dating, but it did have the dating of the Birmingham and Sana manuscripts in it. But then here's something very peculiar happen. He posts a snippet, I think it was a screenshot, of the conclusions of the guy that did the study itself in Lyon, France. Now, the conclusion of the guy that did the study that produced the date of 388 was that you had residue on the sample that was tested, meaning that that would throw the date off. But what those people who are not familiar with carbon-14 dating or AMS dating is that when you introduce recent carbon, instead of making the sample older, back to 388, recent carbon would actually make it younger. It would push the date up into the 700s, the 800s, the 900s. So recognize this. I'm like, well, wait a second. This doesn't even make sense. If you're going to say that this has residue on it, that would make it younger. So the problem is residue is recent contamination and would make it younger. Okay, I just said that. All right. So I called him on it. So we went back and forth on the implications of all this, and then he asked what citation when I said it was a smudge mark. I used smudge mark, it was residue, but the same thing. And I couldn't – I was going back through the thread, and I couldn't find it. Well, the reason why I couldn't find it, and he kept demanding and asking for it, was that he had gone in and deleted it. And so when I was going back and scanning the thread, I said, well, wait a second. I was referring to it right here. What happened to it? He's like, oh, I deleted it. Well, thanks for telling me. And then he's trying to embarrass me by saying, what are you talking about? What are you talking about? What are you talking about? And this is one of the most popular Islamic debaters. It's a dishonest practice, and he knows it, and it shouldn't be tolerated. Okay, so where am I going? I am right there. Thank you, Jim Carrey. I was just reading my chat room. You guys need to behave in there. I see Cog showed up. Thank you, Cog, for coming. A guest is there. I think that is the church lady. Thank you for coming. And Tim, Tap in the Truth is there. Thank you for coming, Tim. And also thank you for calling in last week. And Vorpabite, thank you, sir, for coming. And then over here on my – I'm afraid to touch my own page here because I'm afraid I'm going to delete it and do something bad. So I just kind of leave this one alone. But I see the people, Mike's here, Nadir's here. Stephanie, my show promoter, came. I mean, you know what happened with her this week? She gets banned for tagging the show and promoting the show in the threads where she's a moderator. They ban her from it. Guys, for Pete's sake, quit being so thin-skinned and afraid. Well, I can see why you're going to be afraid, because what I'm about to lay on you, you're not going to want out there. You're not going to want there in your on your websites, I guess, or on your Facebook pages. Okay, so let's look at anachronisms that we find in the Quran. So what is an anachronism? The definition of an anachronism, I know this is kind of boring, but listen carefully. An anachronism is an act of attributing a custom, event, or object to a period to which it does not belong. Let me say it again, just so we all know what we're talking about here. An anachronism is an act of attributing a custom, event, or object to a period to which it does not belong. Now, we can look at Hollywood for having some really great examples of anachronisms, because Hollywood will create movies that are supposed to be taking place in times gone past. And when we look at one of my favorite movies is Indiana Jones. It was the first one. I think it was the Temple of Doom. But it's set during the 1930s, prior to World War II, prior to the Nazis invading Poland. And he's in one of the scenes enjoying a drink in Cairo, where everybody else in Cairo around him is dressed in your typical Arabic outfits, long robes, turbans, so on and so forth. Except one fella comes walking back of the scene wearing a pair of blue jeans and a t-shirt. That is an anachronism. I'm not saying that blue jeans or t-shirts did not exist at the time, but that's kind of wasn't the style at the time. But I got a better one. This one, if you look at Braveheart, the movie of Braveheart, and you know, freedom, you know, the Braveheart Mel Gibson movie, you know, that great show. And during the movie, there's this big battle, and they have this cavalry charge coming at them. This is the scene where they have those big long pikes, and they're going to stick the horses when they come up on them. Well, in one of the frames behind the horses, you know, they're sitting there riding. This is supposed to take place in, I don't know, 1000 AD somewhere. I don't know when it's supposed to take place, but you know, a long time ago, centuries ago. And they're riding along, and you got people that are charging, and they're yelling, and they're getting closer and closer. And then behind one of the horses, you see a Toyota. Yeah. That's an anachronism. That Toyota, if this is in fact the year 1000 AD, that Toyota shouldn't be there. It shouldn't be even close. Another one. The movie Gladiator. Everybody loves Gladiator. Russell Crowe and his fight scenes in the Roman Colosseum. Everybody loves that show. But in one of the fight scenes, he's in Sicily. And this is where he's like, are you not pleased? What does he say there? I wrote that down. Are you not pleased? Are you not entertained? If you remember, he goes in there and it was just him and he kills like eight guys. Well, everybody in the crowd is cheering him and they're all saying, Maximus, Maximus. And then you got one guy in the corner who's got a video camera videotaping it. That's an anachronism. So when we think of an anachronism, this is a person, object, custom that is ascribed to a period in which it did not exist. That Toyota didn't belong in Braveheart. That video camera does not belong in Gladiator. Because why? We know when these things were invented. And we have the same things in the Quran. So my question is, does Allah make the same mistakes as Hollywood movie producers? And I would hope not, or at least I would think that you hope your faith says it doesn't. So let's start with kind of a simple one, and that is the dirham coins in Joseph's day. According to Sirah 12:20, Joseph's brother sold him for a miserable price, for a few dirhams, counted out in such low estimation did they hold him. So here Muhammad's commenting on, or Allah's commenting on the selling of Joseph into slavery. And he sold him for, according to Muhammad, a few dirhams. The problem with this claim is that the dirham, which is a derivative of the Greek drachma, are you following me so far? The Greek drachma didn't exist prior to the 12th century BC. This means the Quran makes the claim that Joseph was sold into slavery using a currency that had not yet been invented and would not be invented until 7 centuries later. Now, if you look at Genesis 37:28, that comments and opines on the same exact event. They used the currency of the day, which was the shekel, and they gave him the correct amount, which was 20 pieces of shekel for Joseph being sold into slavery. So here you have a clear anachronism. The Greek Empire did not start expanding and becoming popularized until, what was it, 330, 340 BC? Joseph lived in what? Joseph, from the story of Joseph, we go Joseph, we got Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph. So about 1800 BC. I don't know. That's the only difference about, what, 3,000 or 1,000 years? Here they're saying that it was used 7 centuries later. Okay, whatever. Oh, that's a half a millennia, folks. He's way off on this. That is an anachronism and a clear example of how the Quran cannot be from God and Muhammad was making it up. The furthest mosque. We read in the Quran, it says, Glory be to him who made his servant go on a night from the sacred mosque to the remote mosque of which we have blessed the precincts so that we may show him some of our signs. Surely he is hearing the saying. So here you have Muhammad traveling to the furthest mosque, or the, what do you call it, the most remote mosque. Is that what it says? The most remote mosque of which we have blessed the precincts. And this has been part of Islamic tradition for 1,400 years now, that Muhammad traveled to Jerusalem on a winged horse, Barak, or traveled to the night to Jerusalem, I think it was, and then traveled up to heaven to see God and Moses and all those people. And it's thought to be the Al-Aqsa Mosque, what is in Jerusalem today. As a matter of fact, Abdullah Malik, the caliph at the time in 691, he's the one that built the Dome of the Rock. But you notice I said 691, the Dome of the Rock, which is supposed to be a shrine commemorating this night journey. A shrine, which I might add, oh, by the way, that doesn't even mention this night journey. The only thing it mentions is a bunch of, you know, say not three, Jesus was only a messenger, you know, don't exceed in your beliefs, oh Christian. You know, it's just, it's a testament to anti-Christ. I'm not calling the people who built it or go there a bunch of anti-Christ, okay? Just don't get your undies in a bunch of this. But it is anti-Christ, anti-deity of Christ is what it turns out to be. But Muhammad supposedly traveled to this furthest mosque, the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which wasn't built until 705. So here you have a story of Muhammad traveling to the furthest mosque that hadn't even been built yet. How does that work out? That is an anachronism. Here's probably just some of the most solid slam dunk evidence. Did David produce chain mail? Well, according to Sirah 34:10-11, here's what it says. We bestowed grace aforetime on David from ourselves. O ye mountains, sing back the praises of Allah with him, and ye birds also. And we made the iron soft for him, commanding, make thou coats of mail, balancing well the rings of chain armor, that's mail, and work ye righteousness, for be sure I see clearly all that ye do. Here's the problem. David lived about 1000 BC. Chainmail was not invented by the Celts until the 5th century BC. This is a half a millennia off. We find no chainmail prior to the Celts in England, which is another continent away, oh, by the way, for another 500 years. So how can that phone be in Washington's hand making that call to the French Navy? How can David be wearing chainmail that wasn't going to be invented for centuries after he lived? This is an anachronism. Another one. Was crucifixion practiced in ancient Egypt? According to Surah 12, verse 41, it says, O my fellow prisoners, in the court of Pharaoh, O my fellow prisoners, as one of you, he will pour out wine for his Lord to drink, and as for the other, he will be crucified so that the birds will eat from his head. Thus the case judged concerning which ye did inquire. And then if you go over to Surah 20, verse 71, Pharaoh said, ye put faith in him before I give you leave. Lo, he is your chief who taught you magic. Now surely I shall cut off your hands and your feet alternatively, and I shall crucify you on the trunks of palm trees, and you shall know for certain which of us has sterner and more lasting punishment. So here you have two verses in the Quran that have Pharaoh, 2000 BC, or 1800 BC, crucifying people. Here's the problem. The method of execution by crucifixion was practiced during, according to this, during the time of Joseph and Moses, respectively, by the Egyptians. The former lived during the 19th century BC, and the latter lived during the 15th century BC. Okay, so you have Joseph and Moses both saying Pharaoh is practicing crucifixion. Crucifixion, for those of you who know it, was used by the Romans for 500 years. So this during the time of Christ, this was a very popular form of the administering the death penalty. It was finally abolished, oh, by the way, by Constantine. Unfortunately, however, this mode of execution was first invented, follow me now, 1800 and 1400 BC, Joseph, Moses. It was not invented until, what does this say here, until the 6th century BC by the Phoenicians. Yeah, 1,000 years before this practice was employed. And there is no, and I would challenge you if you disagree with me, there is no historical record prior to the Phoenicians of anybody using crucifixion. And I would more particularly, with the multiplicity and the abundance that we have of Egyptian texts, I would think that you would be able to produce something showing that people were crucified in Egypt during this time period. Now, some people have, I did my research on it. I don't want to say I'm absolutely slam dunk thorough, but I have OCD. I get my mind wrapped around something. I am going to go to the mat looking it up. And some people have argued that Genesis 40:19 alludes to it, and this isn't true. This is the dream of Joseph, predicts on the baker's head will be cut off and his body will be hung on a pole. It says nothing about nailing him to the pole. It'll be hung after they cut the head off, because crucifixion is to kill somebody. That's the method of killing him. Well, you're cutting somebody's head off here, and then you're hanging the pole on the body as an example. That's not crucifixion. So again, crucifixion was a very important form of punishment for the Romans, at least. As a matter of fact, our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ was crucified. And this was a discussion that I had a number of weeks ago. And it isn't just, let's see here. I just got this PM, Kel. I'm sorry. Okay. Has he called in yet? I'm assuming he has not. Nadir, if you're going to call in, the area code is, the number is area code 319-527-6706. And I don't see him in the studio either, Kel. So hopefully he'll be calling in soon. All right. So when we're talking about crucifixion and the crucifixion of Jesus, this is one of the things that we just beat this horse to death the first part of September. I think it was the first 3 weeks of September on the show. We were talking about all of the evidence that we have for Christ being crucified, and how in Surah 4, verse 157, it denies that Jesus was crucified on the cross, and there's no evidence to state otherwise. And we're not just using the biblical record. We're using also mainly, and this is what has a lot of the secular scholarship saying, yeah, that the death of Christ on a cross is the most attested event from antiquity. They come out and say this, and the reason why is you have Thallus, who lived in 52 AD, who's a Sumerian historian, saying it. Philegion, the first century Greek writer for Rome, is saying it. Lucian, who's a second century satirist for Greece, is saying it. Maribin Serapion mentions it in his discourse in 73 AD. Josephus, the Jewish historian turned Roman in the middle of the first century, says that Jesus died on a cross. Tacitus, who's another Roman historian, in 110 AD, says that he died on a cross. And you have all kinds of other attestation saying that Jesus died on the cross by the method of crucifixion. But crucifixion did not exist during the time of Moses and Joseph when they were living in Egypt and when they were dealing with Pharaoh in Egypt. That is an anachronism. Here's another goodie. Moses and the Samaritans. Now, this one is almost comical. In in the Quran, Surah 20, 85 through 85, or 88 and 95, we read, and this is the story where Moses has led the people out of Egypt, and he goes up to Mount Sinai, and when he's on Mount Sinai, he's up there for so long, they convince Aaron to construct a golden calf. And by constructing a golden calf, They commit sin, and they're punished for it. I'm trying to get back over here. This is the problem with having this over here. Okay, so there I see Nadir's there. Okay, we'll be getting to you in just a couple minutes, Nadir. So here you have this golden calf, and it says, we've tempted by the peoples that thou didst leave them. The Samaritan has led them into error. Then Moses returned, and we cast the gold. Okay, so it says the Samaritan. Here's the problem. The Samaritan people did not exist until after the northern kingdom had been taken into exile. Let me say this again. Let me just make sure that we understand this. The Samaria, the town of Samaria, and had not been developed until 871 BC. Or not 871, did I have it? 870 BC, okay? And then the people of Samaria were not, how do I phrase this? They were not called Samaritans until 721 BC, when the 10 northern kingdoms were taken into captivity by Sargon II into Assyria. And when they did this, this is how they rolled. This is the Nebuchadnezzar did the same thing, and other rulers of the day did the same thing. When they would conquer an area, they would take the majority of the people out of that area and then force other people to move into there. This way you would interbreed, you would have the culture itself would be destroyed, and they would be easier to rule, and you would be able to impose your own laws and governors. Well, here, the Samaritans were, of course, hated by the southern kingdom, and they were even hated clear up to the time of Christ. You know, if you had the story of Christ at the well with the Samaritan woman, and how in order to get from Galilee down to Jerusalem or Jerusalem up to Galilee, they would go around the west side of the Jordan River, the east side of the Jordan River, because Samaria was on the west side of the Jordan River. So they would avoid it. Well, here Jesus is going through Samaria, and this is anyway. So you have a Samaritan building a golden calf, 1400 BC, 500 years prior to Samaria even being founded. That is an anachronism. Confusing Mary and Maryam. I've gone over this several times on this show. As a matter of fact, this is one of the things that the great line of Dawa wanted to get on me about how that's not actually Mary, mother of Jesus. That is Maryam, the sister. No, it's not. You get in Surah 20, 30. Muhammad clearly in this verse clearly understands that Aaron was the brother of Moses. So we know that Muhammad knew Aaron was the brother of Moses. But when you get in 1928, he has Mary, the mother of Jesus, is spoken of as being the sister of Aaron, which would make her the sister of Moses, and her name was Maryam. You get in Surah 66:12, it's the same thing. It says that the mother of Mary the father of Mary, is Imram. Well, how can the father of Mary be Imram if Imram lived 1400, and this is the same Mary as the mother of Jesus that they're speaking about. How can Imram be her father when he lived 1400 years prior to Mary being born in the first century? How does that work out? I don't know. And then the other one is Surah 3, verses 33 through 45, and it starts with the genealogies, and it goes from Imram, and then it goes straight to Mary. It has Noah in there and has Adam in there, but then it goes from Imram, boom, down to Mary, mother of Jesus. There's no change in context. So here, this is anachronism when he has the wrong person at the wrong time period. And I know there's all kinds of apologetics out there, and they're saying, well, Mary was part of the tribe of Levi. She wasn't part of the tribe of Levi. She wasn't part of the lineage of Aaron. And I know what you're going to do. You're going to go to Luke 5 or 1:5 and say, this is the daughter of Aaron, yada, yada, yada. When Luke specifically states that she was, her father was Heli, and that she was in the line of Judah. Case closed. Moses and Haman. Now, Haman, who do we know Haman? Haman is an advisor to Xerxes, who was the ruler of the Medo-Persian Empire at the time of Esther. Who knew? But also, evidently, this guy in Surah 28:5-8 is an advisor to Pharaoh. Who knew? Also in Surah 28:38, it also says, O Haman, bake the mud, and they're building a Tower of Babel. Pharaoh was going to build a Tower of Babel. Here you have a Chaldean name in an Egyptian story. This is an anachronism. He got the names of these people mixed up when he was telling these stories. Is what happened here. Amon lived in the 6th century, whereas the story that he is setting here is in the 14th century, the 6th century BC, where this is in the 14th century. This is 800 years off. Yeah, Amon's a Persian name. Why is Pharaoh building a tower? Yeah, that's one of the things, notes I wrote there. So here you have several examples of anachronisms. There's other anachronisms in there that would take too long to explain, but there are several anachronisms in the Quran where you have people, places, events, things that should not be there. And we know this because historically we can demonstrate when they were invented, when they were used. To the other side of this, we don't have anything supporting this. So this is exactly what you'd find in a text that is prone to error. This, along with many other proofs I offered on this show every single week, I'm going to say this again, the Talmudic commentary that we find in the Quran, the Gnostic stories, gospel stories that we find in the Quran, the Syriac children's stories and folk tales that we find in the Quran. And then, as far as I'm concerned, the slam dunk proof that Jesus was crucified that everybody in history says happened. Now, these examples clearly demonstrate the Quran cannot be from an omniscient, which is an all-knowing God. And that is from, just as we would expect, if these kind of anachronisms are in it, from a man who was making it up in a land where nobody knew any different. He's talking to people that were essentially illiterate. And the only people that really challenged him on that were the people who were lettered, the Jews and the Christians. So the bottom line is anachronisms are slam dunk evidence that we can know that the Quran is not true. Okay, so that took a little longer than I thought, and I apologize. Let me see here. Nadir is still on here. He's been on here for 7 minutes. So, Nadir, sir, I am going to work my magic here. I'm getting such a great operator of this on the board. Are you there, sir?
Yeah, I'm here.
Ah, there you are. Okay. Sometimes I question myself. Did I actually push the right button here? I'm not good at this. Like Cal is. And I appreciate you calling in and being patient with me today. We are going to be discussing, as far as I know, this is what we discussed on Facebook when we were IMing each other. Where do we find Muhammad in the Bible? And I just want to preface this and set things up for people. The Quran mentions in Surah 7, verse 157, it says, "Those who follow the messenger, the unlettered prophet, whom they find mentioned in their own scriptures, in the law, in the gospel." So the Quran says that we're going to find Muhammad in the Bible, in the Torah, the first five books of the Bible, and the gospels. And so as a Muslim apologist, somebody who does Dawah like yourself, you're going to tell us that we do find Muhammad there, and you're going to tell us where we find Muhammad. And one of the most popular ones, of course, as both of us know, is Deuteronomy 18:18. So if you want to go ahead and just give a lead-in to let people know who you are and what you do, or if you just want to jump into the topic, the floor is yours, sir. Go ahead and take it from here.
Oh, okay, thank you. Actually, I guess we have a little bit in common. We're both from the Midwest. I'm from Peoria, Illinois, and you're out there in Des Moines, Iowa, or where exactly are you located?
Iowa, sir.
Oh, right. Okay, Iowa, yeah. So that's nice. It's like, maybe a 2-3 hour from where I live. I'll just jump straight into the topic. So the reason why the reason why I'm actually discussing and debating this is not really so much for why the Quran, because the Quran states it, but because many people have shown, and people who are not Muslim, by the way, that Moses was very much like Muhammad. So, in fact, one reference I'll give you is Reverend James L. Dow in his Collins Dictionary of the Bible. In speaking about Moses, he said, "The only man in history who can be compared even remotely is Muhammad." And Time Magazine also, July 14th, 1974, in the article over there by Jules Maserman, she's again made the same correlation that when speaking about Muhammad, she compared him to Moses. So this is, and as we talk, you're going to see a lot of similarities. I don't know if you want to comment on that.
No. Go ahead. Take your time. This is going to be this is not a debate. This is a discussion. So,
Sure.
You provided a Time magazine article saying, and the other one was a Christian scholar. You said that that
correct.
Muhammad. I didn't get his qualifications.
Reverend James L. Dow, in his Collins Dictionary of the Bible, page 402.
Okay.
And you can always email me.
Okay,
I can send you the references. Yeah. So, I think when we discuss this, there's like a big elephant in the room here, and I just want to just talk about it. And that is, people tend to find things in the Bible that really aren't there. I'm probably sure you've experienced it with discussing with maybe Jehovah's Witnesses, Mormons, Catholics. Everybody's really just kind of putting their own interpretation on the Bible, and they're kind of ignoring maybe the proper way of doing exegesis, or they're making the Bible to read the way they want to. And so what I would like to offer you guys tonight is I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to put my interpretation of the Bible. I will only state fact. In fact, what I would like for you to do for me, if you ever see me kind of veering off and giving some kind of interpretation of the scripture, I want you to stop me right there and then say, hey, that's your own interpretation. And if you could do that for me, that'd be great.
Okay.
Yeah. So please stop me if I ever go in there. And again, I'm just going to state fact today. So that was the first thing I wanted to bring up. Going to Deuteronomy chapter 18, verse 18, it says over there that I will raise a prophet like unto you, referring to Moses. And I'll ask you to please read from the King James Bible, because the NIV and other versions, they try, it's polemical. They it's not a word-for-word translation. And so those aren't very reliable Bible translations. You want to stick to the King James Version. So let me quote out of there. It says,
Let me just say something real quick about the King James Version, and you can use it. And I don't have a problem with you using that. Is that the King James Version was used from the Textus Receptus, which was written, I think, around 1400 by Erasmus, and it's really not the most accurate version. And this, I know, I'm just picking at straws here. I'm bad at this. But when we look at the majority text, which is the majority of a comparison of the majority of what the Greek manuscripts say, that's when you get into the newest American Standard Version. That's when you get into the New English Translation and things like that. But, just so we know that the King James Version came much later based on a manuscript that was written in the middle of the 14th century.
Okay, thanks for
I didn't
that.
Know.
And, yeah, so the reason why I'm staying away from NIV is because it's polemical in a sense, like it's not a lot of it is they're actually putting in their own refutations to the arguments leveled against the Bible within the text, and that's not honest. That's wrong thing to do, and I think you'll see that inside Deuteronomy 18:18. But anyway, let's just get back. So Muhammad is very much like Moses, and I'll explain. But before I go there, I also want to point out that there could be, I could get very silly with this. I could probably say, hey, look, I'm like Moses. Yeah, see, that prophet is me. Here, let me show you how I'm like Moses. Moses didn't eat pork. Yeah, I don't eat pork. Moses prayed to one God. I pray to one God. There, you see, it's me. Now, here's my point. We can try to, anybody probably can bring out some general similarities which we all share, like Moses had two eyes. I have two eyes. There you go, I'm the prophet. But we need to focus on the unique characteristics of Moses that you and I and the other people don't have. Okay, so I also want to make that clear. And when you do that, you will see it really only fits one person, and that's Muhammad. For example, Moses was a warrior prophet. He was the commander of an army, and he fought in these battles like a general prophet. In fact, if you could, Eric, if you could perhaps name off some battles Moses fought, because I actually don't know. Maybe you could probably tell us more about that.
No, I can't tell you off the top of my head which battles he fought. It was mainly Joshua who did the majority of the fighting, if you get down to it. But Moses was, if not mistaken, he was overseeing a battle, and they had to hold his arms up. I can't remember which one that was, but I think it was mainly Joshua who was a general for the army itself.
Yeah, he did fight
now,
there may be
battles out there. I just can't name them off the top of my head. I'd have to Google it.
Well, okay, and so I'll probably when you go to the website Voice of Jesus, it says Wars and Slaughters Under Moses. So just to give you some background, there's actually a lot of criticism of that because Moses put men, women, and children to death, and we'll get those verses. So I was kind of leaning on you, but that's okay. We'll get those passages later. Well, here's my point. Moses was a warrior, prophet. Muhammad was a warrior prophet. He fought the Battle of Badr, the Battle of Hunain, and so many other battles. So here we see that not only were they warrior prophets, but they were victorious. Both of them were lawgivers. This is another distinction. Which they have. Now, of course, I could try to be a warrior prophet, but I don't think I'd be very good. I think I'd probably get arrested or something. You'll see me on Ruby Ridge. So my point here, these are not things which you and I can do. And so there is similarity. Now you can begin to see why other people have drawn the similarities, those references I gave you. Yes, there are similarities, unique similarities between Moses and Muhammad, which cannot be denied. And finally, both of them made the Great Migration. So you can imagine the site where you have your whole followers behind you, and you're migrating from the land, persecution, to the land where you're safe. Moses did that, and I think they call it the Exodus. Muhammad did it. It's called the Hijra. He migrated from Mecca to Medina. They both made this Great Migration. So how am I doing so far, Eric? Have I put my own interpretation in any of this yet? Let me know.
I would agree with that. I was looking at I Googled that for us here. The Battle of Rephidim. Rephidim is described in the Bible as a battle between the Jews. Moses urged the faithful to fight and placed his people under the leadership of Joshua, is what that says. So actually, Moses did not fight in that. But I'm not arguing whether or not Moses wasn't a military commander. You can make that argument based on the fact that the Jews did indeed have to fight while they were out in the wilderness, and after Moses died, they really had to fight in order to reclaim Canaan. So I'm not arguing the fact that he you could classify him as a warrior prophet, and you obviously can classify Muhammad as a warrior prophet. And I'm not going to argue the fact that Moses, of course, was a lawgiver, and that Muhammad was a lawgiver, and I'm not going to argue the fact that Moses made the Exodus, led the people of Egypt out of the millions of people, I might add, out of Egypt where Muhammad led 100, 150 people from Mecca to Yathra or Medina. I'm not, so for you have no disagreement out of me as we stand right now.
Okay, good. All right, so it's great that we're all seeing eye to eye on the facts. So this is, in my opinion, this is kind of a big development in the sense, like, if you ever debate with Jehovah's Witnesses, Mormons, Catholics, is deeply rooted in their own interpretation of the Bible, and there's a lot of holes in it. You know, this is such a good argument showing, I even use this against atheists. This is not just a challenge for Christianity, but for atheists. One of my recent debates with an atheist, I said, listen, you guys mock the Bible, and to them, it's just a book, not a holy book, but it's just a book. I said, this book presented a warrior prophet named Moses. In fact, the Bible also said that he committed many atrocities as well, and you can get those verses for you later. But that's beside the point. I said, listen, the Bible promised that a prophet like Moses would come, and here you go. How do you explain that? In my discussion with the atheist, he was not able to answer. So maybe my question I'm going to raise for you, Eric, how do you explain the Bible promising a guy like Moses coming, and here he comes, and the only thing I can think you're going to do is just reinterpret the Bible. And so I hope you can have a better explanation than that, than just another interpretation of the Bible. Go ahead.
So you're asking me how I would interpret what that 1818 says? Is that what you're asking?
Well, I guess my question to you is, how do you explain the similarities, unique similarities between Muhammad and Moses?
It requires kind of a lengthy answer. And I don't just go to 1818. You have to examine the text, the context of the text and what's going on here when Moses makes this statement in 1818. And you have to back it up to 1815 and read it through 1819, which includes 1818. So you have 15, 16, 17, 18, and 19. You have five verses here, and I have them right here. It says, the Lord, beginning in 15, it says, the Lord will raise up to you, or for you, a prophet like me from among you, from your own. And this one is the Net Bible that says the Israelites, and this is probably something that you're going to disagree with the interpretation, but it would, in other translations, it says from your own brethren, from your own countrymen. So it depends on when you get in a Strong's Concordance. It's number 251. I'm not sure if you know aware of the number in Strong's Concordance, but it is brethren, your countrymen, the people of Israel is what it's saying. And then it goes on to say in 15, you must listen to him. And then this is the important part. It occurs in verse 16. It says, this accords with what happened in Horeb in the days of the assembly. Now, what happened in Horeb? Here you have God specifically speaking directly to the Israel people from Mount Sinai. He's giving them the Ten Commandments. When we find this in Exodus, I'll be reading that here in a second. And it says here that you asked the Lord your God, please do not make us hear the voice of the Lord our God anymore or see the great fire anymore, lest we die. So just being, and this is where, you know, you can actually picture these people pleading with Moses, saying, look, we have been in the presence, us the finite, being in the presence of the infinite God, and he's speaking to us, and it's terrifying us. It's like when we look at the New Testament. Anytime an angel appears, or in the Old Testament, anytime an angel appears, it says, be not afraid. Because if an angel came here in the Capra Cave right now and appeared, I would be scared to death because this is something that does not belong. So here they're asking him, Moses, give us somebody that will speak on behalf of God so we're not terrified every time we hear from God. Then in verse 17 it says, the Lord said to me, what they have said is good. I will raise up a prophet like you from them among their fellow, and here it says Israelites, countrymen, brethren. You could put all those in there.
Which
I will
is
put
wrong.
Words in his mouth. Why is that wrong?
Because the text of the – see, this is what I'm talking about. They're getting polemical. They're trying to refute me and the Muslims. But the text –
well, this isn't the NIV.
Right. Well, the new modern day translations, I can assure you, whether you're using the Greek or the Hebrew, that Israelite is not in there. It's from amongst your brethren. So they're just, that's why I'm saying you got to go to the King James, because they're not trying to, convince you.
That's a great point. Nadir, that's a great point. I'm going to address it here in just a couple minutes. You make a great point right there. And let me, as a matter of fact, let me go ahead and highlight that, brethren. Okay. And then we get, the Lord said to me, we have said it's good, I'll raise up a prophet like you from among their fellow Israelites, from their brethren, interchangeable. I will put words in my mouth and he'll speak. Okay, that's 18. And then I will personally hold responsible anyone who then pays no attention to the words that the prophets shall speak in my name. So when we look at what happened at Mount Horeb, and we find that in Exodus 20:18, and it says, all the people were seeing the thundering and the lightning and heard the sound of the horn and saw the mountain smoking. When the people saw it, they trembled with fear and kept their distance. They were scared out of their wits. They say to Moses, you speak to us and we will listen, but do not let God to speak us, lest we die. So here you have a parallel version of this in Exodus 20, verses 18 through 20, and Moses said to the people, do not fear, for God has come to test you. That fear, okay, da-da-da-da. So what we see this, God is now going to send prophets to speak on his behalf. not just one, but a series of prophets, people to speak. Because if you look at all the prophets of the Old Testament, they all speak for God. Daniel spoke for God. He performed miracles. Ezekiel spoke for God. All these prophets of the Old Testament, minor and major, spoke for God. So they're in basically setting up an office of, you could say, of a prophet here. But when you get to Deuteronomy chapter 34, and this is what I am'd you, when we start comparing what this prophet would be like, and you said that you would have different interpretations. Jehovah's Witness would say something, the Mormons would say something. I actually went to the Jews and read a couple things that Jews said that this guy would be like and who this guy is. And it might, I don't know, maybe it won't surprise you. Maybe you've talked about this way more than I have. But here in Deuteronomy 34, which is the last chapter, and it addresses what this prophet would be like, does it say he would be a warrior? No. Does it say he would be a lawgiver? No. Does it say that he would be making a migration? No. The Bible clarifies what 18:18 says, and here's what it says in 34:9-12. It says, now Joshua, the son of Nun, was full of the spirit of wisdom. For why was Joshua full of the spirit? Because Moses had placed his hands on him, and the Israelites listened to him and did just what the Lord had commanded Moses. Then you get in verse 10, it says, no prophet ever again arose in Israel like Moses, who knew the Lord face to face. He did all the signs and wonders the Lord had sent him to do. So those two qualifications there alone in Deuteronomy, the same book that you're quoting the prophecy of Moses about, says that this is what a prophet will do. He can speak to God face to face. This prophet will speak to God face to face, and he will do wonders in the accompaniment of the people of Israel. Do you agree with that?
Okay, yeah. Let me just start addressing that. The first thing I think, let's see the big difference between what we're doing here. You're really getting very deep into interpretation, and this is exactly what all the other people do. The Jehovah's Witnesses, Mormon, they start kind of spinning their own interpretation. But notice how, at least thus far, I've been very true to the facts. I only give the facts. I don't go into the deep interpretation. But let me just summarize kind of what
you
said.
Hey, Nadir, hold on a second. You said that I'm not stating facts. I'm quoting scripture. This is right in scripture. This is factual, and it's in the same book, in the same exact book. And remember, Deuteronomy was only written over a very short period, like 6 weeks. Moses wrote this right at the end of his life. So he's including all of this in the same book. Now, this is an addendum, of course, because we know Joshua wrote this part and put it in there because it says that Moses had died. But this occurs in a very short period of time. Okay, go ahead.
Well, I'll address that. But one thing I would disagree with you said, yeah, I'm going to go to the Jews and see how they interpret that. And I think that's just a big mistake. Because if you go to the Jews, they're going to interpret things to exclude both Jesus and Muhammad. In fact, on that Deuteronomy 34, some Jews even say that this can never refer to Jesus because it says no prophet will ever come again like Moses. So I don't know. I guess my point here is this actually signifies a problem that Jews have misinterpreted their scriptures. Christians are misinterpreting their scriptures to exclude Muhammad. Jews are doing it both, exclude Jesus and Muhammad. But before I answer you, Eric, let me first summarize, if I understand you correctly. What you're saying is that God, that the likeness and similarity of Deuteronomy 18:18 has to be that he speaks to God face to face and he does wonders. Is that what you're saying?
That's according to Deuteronomy 34, verses 10
well,
and 11.
Yeah, see, that's what you know, there is actually an article I was reading. It's called toughquestionsanswered.org. I got posted in the text there. It says,
but isn't an article somebody's interpretation, Nadir? Nadir, isn't an article somebody's interpretation of?
Well, the article is common errors of interpretation, and one of the common errors is called a false combination. This approach combines elements from here and there in the passage and make a point out of their combination. And I think that's what you're doing, though. even though the elements themselves are not directly connected in the passage themselves. So when I read Deuteronomy 18:18, I don't see any reason to interpret the likeness in the way the likeness was in Deuteronomy chapter 34. I think this is a false combination in which you're just trying to combine this, because what you're doing, you're really not refuting why Moses and Muhammad are similar in this unique way. What you're doing, you're trying to create an exclusion principle. But I think that exclusion principle fails because you have no authority to go to Deuteronomy 34 and interpret that way. Deuteronomy 34 simply says, and nobody has arisen in Israel like Moses, meaning they're trying to show how special and unique he was. In that, you know, he spoke, I think that, I don't know if the text says, spoke to God face to face. I'll have to look, I don't have the Bible in front of me. And then he said he did many miracles. Well, Muhammad also did many miracles as well. Speak to God face to face.
Muhammad did miracles. The Quran specifically says that he did not work any miracles. They were begging him to provide miracles, some type of sign. The only thing that says that he did miracles is actually the Hadith.
No, the Quran does not say he never did any miracles. In fact, one of the miracles which Muhammad did was he split the moon in half, and then a surah, a chapter of the Quran was revealed. I think it was Surah Qamar, which was revealed on behalf of that miracle. The truth of the matter is Muhammad did several miracles. One of the miracles, another miracle I'll give you, is that he healed. There was a battle called the Battle of Khaybar. Ali wasn't able to participate because he had some eye problems. Then Muhammad applied some saliva to his eyes and supplicated, and he was miraculously healed as if there was no ailment at all. He also fed people from dozens of people from a very small amount of food. The miracles go on and on and on. So we're looking at hundreds of miracles here, Eric. So that's simply a false statement, which I think has been circulating. And the good thing is that at least now I'm correcting that. Got the opportunity to do so.
So I'm just typing it in right now. Let's see. In Surah 637, why has no sign been sent down upon him from the Lord? Surah 2, verse 118, why does a sign not come to us? Surah 6:109, then they swore by God of the Most Earnest, if a sign comes to them, they will believe it. Surah 10:20, why has a sign not been sent down to him from the Lord? Surah 13:7, why has a sign not sent down to him from the Lord? Thou art only a warner and a guide to every people. So he says that he did not have a sign given to him from the Lord, but you insist that there was, and I'm not going to quibble on this. I mean, this is just something that, you know, this is, you know, if I interpret this, okay, when we start talking about our own interpretation and exegesis and eisegesis of the text, this is something that I can say with a lot of certitude that says, look, the Quran affirms the fact that Muhammad did not perform any miracles. It is only when you interpret certain sections of those as miracles is if you can insert those in there, even though when it clearly says that they don't exist. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, so kind of going back to what you're saying, the text which you are quoting from the Bible, I think you might be misinterpreting. It doesn't say that Muhammad didn't do any miracles. This was a false argument of the non-believers, because, again, Surah Qamar came in response to this, where they said, why don't you show us a sign? Why don't you do a miracle? And then he split the moon in half. So also going back to Deuteronomy chapter 34, verse 10, that it says here, and there arose not a prophet in Israel like unto Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face. The text does not say he spoke to him face to face. So God knows everybody face to face. So my point here, going back to Deuteronomy 18:18, what you're doing is that you're trying to define what God really means by likeness. Like, of course, there's many qualities of Moses. God is referring to this quality and this quality only, and that's how you have to be likeness.
I'm not defining it, Nadir. God is defining it in his word.
That's your interpretation.
Okay, so anytime that I would comment on what let's just look at another verse here in Deuteronomy, the chapter right before it. where 17, 14 through 15, it says, when you come to the land of the Lord your God is giving you and take it over and live in it and say, I will select a king slash ruler like all the nations surrounding me. You must select without fail a king whom the Lord your God chooses from among fellow citizens. You must appoint a king. You may, and here's where it excludes Muhammad. It says, you may not designate a foreigner who is not one of your fellow Israelites. So there it's not my interpretation of this. I am reading you verbatim verses straight from the same book that you say that we find Muhammad in, that number one, mm-hmm. it illustrates what a prophet like Moses would be. And you're saying, well, that's an interpretation. Well, I'm saying that your mm-hmm. interpretation that he was a warrior prophet, that he was a lawgiver, and the migration to Hijra, which was, what, 120, 140 people versus millions of people, is the same thing. And I said, that's your interpretation. So what you're turning around, you're trying to turn around and say, well, this is my interpretation. Well, and it's just something that we're going to have to disagree on.
Okay, there's a lot of things. You're saying, when I said that both Moses and Muhammad made this great big migration, are you saying that's my interpretation or is that a fact?
No, those are facts. But what you're trying to do is you're trying to place this emphasis that Muhammad, how many people went with Muhammad from Mecca to Medina?
Oh boy, I don't have the exact number.
Was it 1,000?
I don't want to guess.
Okay, well, from what I've read, it's been about like 150. That's what I've read. Now, what I've read may be wrong, but let's just say it's 500 people. How many Jews came out? And if you read the book of Numbers, which is from the Torah, millions of Jews came out of Egypt during the Exodus. And when you're trying to compare these two, for me as a Christian, as somebody looking back into history, there is no comparison here at all.
Well, let me
and
tell
that's
you,
mine.
I think I'm not sure the numbers is as important as the significance of the migration from Mecca to Medina. This is a huge focal point in our religion, and it's a huge, has a huge significance in both, actually in both Islam and Christianity and Judaism as well. So, this is a similarity, and whether it's 500 versus 5,000, I guess we could nitpick at that, I guess. But nevertheless, there is a similarity there. But now let me get back to what you were saying about the king. He said, hey, don't choose a king from anybody except one of your own people. Okay, God here is instructing his common sense, don't choose a king like a non-believer to rule over you. Because obviously you're going to be ruling by some strange paganistic type of doctrine or something like that. That makes sense. So God is telling the Israelites, don't do this. But God himself can choose whoever he wants to be a prophet. Once again, there is no correlation between what you quoted here and Deuteronomy 18:18. Now, I just gave you my understanding of that verse. This is an interpretation, but the only time I'll give you an interpretation is to show the holes in your interpretation. But let me get back to where I think the big difference and the deciding point in this discussion is, I'm only giving facts, but your defense, 100% actually, of your defense, Eric, is deeply rooted in interpretations which are riddled with holes and don't make sense.
Here I'm reading directly from Scripture, and you know, the Bible, Paul tells us very clearly, no scripture is for private interpretation. When we read this, God is telling the Israelites, don't ever put somebody as a ruler over you. And that would include, I would hope, a prophet also. But, you know, I had one other thing that I found here in Surah 29:27. It says, and we bestowed on him, this is Muhammad talking about prophethood and the opposite of prophethood. And it said, we bestowed on him Isaac and Jacob, and we established the prophethood and the scripture among his seed. So here they're starting with Isaac and Jacob and saying, okay, it is only prophets that would come from their what? From their seed, from their descendants. Muhammad was not a descendant of Isaac, and he was not a descendant of Jacob. That's the 12 tribes of Israel. Now, Yusuf Ali has gone in his translation in this, and he inserts Abraham in there. And we both know why he is inserting Abraham in there. It is for the interpretation of this verse to include Ishmael, which would then include Muhammad. But by just looking at the Quran itself, Isaac and Jacob, it excludes anybody else from their seed to be a prophet for Israel.
Okay,
now,
is that
a wrong interpretation of the Quran?
Yeah, at least you're somewhat consistent there. Because the Quran does not state that only prophets come from the descendants of Israel. The Quran states the exact opposite. The Quran states from every nation a messenger was sent. So that means that not only Israelites, but also, you could say, from the land of China, from Africa, messengers were sent from every nation.
Do me a favor then. Tell me one prophet that has existed outside of, by name, outside of the covenant of Isaac and Jacob, outside of that seed.
Outside of the Israelite prophets. Right. Is that what you're asking?
Right. Correct, yes.
No, I actually am. I don't know. I don't know how to answer that question, but I'm telling you what the Quran states.
But what I'm trying to demonstrate to you is that the Bible specifically says that the only people that are going to be prophets of God are the Israelites, and that would be from the tribe of, or from Jacob, who had the 12 sons, who made the 12 tribes. That's what the Bible teaches. It doesn't teach somebody that would come from the lineage of Ishmael. As a matter of fact, here's what the Bible does say about Ishmael. Hold on, let's just say what it does say about Ishmael. Where was that? I wrote that down somewhere. It was in Genesis, and I probably put it clear up at the top here. I don't have it. It was in Genesis where it says that Ishmael, God was going to bless him and make him a great nation, but he would have his hand against everybody that he had encountered.
Mm-hmm.
And that is exactly,
sure.
You know, if you follow that line, that's what we find. I know I wrote it down here someplace. Where did I put it? Oh, here it is. Genesis 16:12. Here we go. He will be a wild ass of a man. He will be hostile to everyone, and he will be hostile, and everyone will be hostile to him. And he will live away from his brothers. So here you have a clear exclusion of Ishmael and his seed from Israel. As a matter of fact, the Jews hated the Ishmaelites. Who did they sell Joseph into slavery to? The Ishmaelites. So they have, when we start talking about, okay, 1818 is a prophecy of Muhammad, you can't get there using scripture. You have three things here, a warrior, a lawgiver, and they made a migration, which really is, in my opinion, and this is
an established state.
And established what now?
Established a state.
Established a state. So there's four. Can I read you my list of differences between the two? Would you be interested in listening to that?
Well,
or did you have something else that you wanted to touch on?
Can I just get back to, just address what you're, what you just said before, just let me quickly respond to that.
Yeah, go ahead.
The thing is, I've carefully searched the Bible, and I've listened to debates, and I can assure you there is no verse in the Bible which says only prophets are going to come from Israelites. There simply is not there. This is a retrofitting of the Bible. This is how people make the Bible say what they want it to say. We have seen many attempts to create exclusion principles to exclude Muhammad so people can hold on to this religion. And Christians are not only the only one doing it. Jews are doing the same thing to Jews. So the thing is, the Bible does not state that only they're going to come from Israelite prophets. The text of the Bible says they are going to come from amongst your brethren. Now, the Ishmaelites, which is the lineage where Muhammad comes from the Ishmaelites, they are the brethren of, they are, I guess, Ishmael was a brother of Isaac, half-brother, you could say. And so, yes, they are the brethren. In fact, it states over here, inside Genesis chapter 16, verses 11 through 12, God specifically says about the verse that you're quoting, by the way, Eric. It says, he will be a wild donkey of a man. His hand will be against everyone and everyone's hand against him. And he will live in hostility towards all his brothers. Okay? So the Ishmaelites are the brothers of the Israelites. And that's what God said. I will raise from amongst you a prophet from amongst your brethren.
Yeah, I'm trying to see how that applies to the Israelites. Well, to all of his brothers, that could mean all of his kin. That's what I'm interpreting that as.
Well, see, when you look at brethren, it could be either two groups of people. It could be either the 12 tribes of Israel. Well, actually, it's more than two people, now that I think about it. It could be the 12 tribes of Israel. It could be the Ishmaelites. It could even be the Esau. So Isaac had two sons. Isaac had Esau and Jacob. From Jacob comes the 12 tribes of Israel. Esau was another son. You get the Turks and Palestinians, I think, from that tribe. Now, they were also referred to as a brethren inside Deuteronomy chapter 2, verse 4, I think, if I'm not. Oh, no, wait a second. I'm sorry. I forgot to write this verse down. It says here, you are about to pass through the territory of your brethren. The word brethren, by the way, is ach. The descendants of Esau. You just Google that, you'll get the, I think it's Deuteronomy chapter 2, verse 4, I think. But my point here is this. All the people, the Jews and the Christians, they're running to the Bible, trying to ad hoc create these exclusion principles to exclude Jesus, to exclude Muhammad. But all of these attempts fail. When God said, I will raise a prophet like unto Moses, he didn't detail it from other passage, Deuteronomy 34. Well, here's what I mean by like. That's your own interpretation that you are reading into the text.
Okay, I'm just trying to bring up Strong's concordance right now, and I was listening to you. What was that, 1612 that we were at? Just to see what it says and what number that used against 1612 and all of his brethren, okay. And it's the application of the word brethren there is where I have a problem. But here's the things, the similarities when we start taking, because if we start looking at, okay, who is this prophet in Deuteronomy 18:18? I've cited several verses from the book of Deuteronomy that basically say all kinds of things here, and I'm just going to list some of the similarities between Moses and Jesus, and then throw Muhammad in there, and then you tell me if this can somehow pertain to Muhammad. Was he a Hebrew? Moses was a Hebrew. Jesus was a Hebrew. Muhammad was not. Moses was literate. He could read and write. Jesus was literate. He could read and write. Muhammad could not. Both left positions of royalty, where Moses left being a prince of Egypt. Jesus left being the Son of God in heaven. Muhammad, no. Both of Jesus and Moses, both were born during the killing of the Jewish babies. Moses was born when they were the midwives were ordered to kill the babies. Jesus in the slaughter of the innocents. Muhammad, well, they were killing little girls before he came along, but that's not specific on the which tribe that came from. Moses hid in Egypt as a child. Jesus hid in Egypt as a child. Muhammad, no. Moses turned water into blood. Jesus turned water into wine. Muhammad, no. Muhammad died on a hill. Jesus died on a hill. No, not Moses or Muhammad. Did I say that wrong? Moses died on a hill. Jesus died on a hill. Muhammad did not. Moses communed with God face to face. Jesus communed to God face to face, and he's seated next to God today. Muhammad, he got his message from an angel. And this is something that I've always been curious about, and maybe you can answer it later. We don't have a lot of time left on the show, but, you know,
when we say that if you're going to give somebody the most important message, if Muhammad's supposed to be the last prophet and this is supposed to be the most important message, why would you, number one, give it orally, and number two, give it to somebody that cannot read or write? For me, I'm at a loss of that. Moses performed miracles, Jesus performed miracles, and when we get down to Muhammad, I would say not one, and the Quran supports that. Moses was hated by the ruling Egyptians, Jesus was hated by the ruling Jewish leaders, Muhammad was accepted by the people of Mecca and Medina. Moses walked on the dry sea bed crossing the Red Sea, Jesus walked on the Sea of Galilee, Moses provided the Israelite manna to the Israelites wandering in the wilderness. Jesus fed the 5,000. Muhammad, no. Moses was transfigured. Now listen to this. Moses was transfigured when he came into the presence of God face to face. As a matter of fact, when he came out of Mount Sinai, they told him to put on a veil because he was glowing with the glory of God on his skin. Jesus on the Mount of Transfiguration. You have John, Peter, and James all attesting to that fact. Muhammad, no. So you have all kinds of different similarities between Moses and Jesus that do not apply to Muhammad. So when we start asking, when you start saying, okay, these are facts that I just stated. So
okay.
which facts are you going to pick and choose is what my argument is. It isn't, you know, whether, okay, well, Muhammad performed this miracle. I'm not even worried about that. I'm talking about all these other facts that I just stated. If you want to make argument based on similarities, it does not hold water when you actually do a side-by-side comparison and say, well, my facts are more important than your facts. Does that make sense to you?
Well, no, I'm going to tell you why. Because what you're doing here is you're trying to show the differences between Moses and Muhammad. And of course there's differences. And of course you're going to find some similarities between Jesus and Muhammad. And I think this is really what it... First, let me just deal with an attempt to try to find differences. You're going to find some big differences between Jesus and Muhammad and Moses. One of the biggest differences is, you know, would you compare a person like Genghis Khan to Mother Teresa? That's a ridiculous comparison. There's a clear difference. So Jesus doesn't fit this. He never fought. He was kind of like a gentle lamb. He didn't fight any of these battles. Okay. So comparing Jesus with Moses, you're going to find many differences between them as well. But the whole attempt of trying to find differences between Jesus, Muhammad, and all three of them is futile. Going back to the Bible, when it says over there, I will raise a prophet like unto you, Moses, we can agree based on facts that it comes down really to two people, Jesus or Muhammad. What is a fact which cannot be denied is that Moses and Muhammad share some very unique characteristics, which none other people share. And only Moses and Muhammad are warrior prophets who came, who were actually successful and started a state and brought a new law. And this, and really, there really is no answer which you have provided to us tonight, why we find similarities between Moses and Muhammad. What you have done tonight, Eric, is just you went to the Bible and you reinterpreted it to make exclusion principles and clauses to exclude Muhammad. Can't be him because this verse says this. But I just went and traded. There's holes in those interpretations that you're giving. Trying to show dissimilarities is futile because you could do show the same dissimilarity as Jesus. But you're not answering the question.
Can I read you something that comes directly from the Bible?
What's that? Nadir,
can I read you something that comes directly from the Bible? I want to read you something that comes straight out of the Bible.
Sure.
And I'm just going to go with Acts chapter 3. And in Acts chapter 3, when you get to verse 22, and Moses said, the Lord your God will, and this is Peter talking, he quotes directly from Deuteronomy 18:18 and makes that application on Jesus Christ. Jesus even said in John 4:45, do you suppose that I accuse you before the Father? The one who accuses you is Moses, in whom you have placed your hope. If you believe in Moses, you would believe me. Why? Because he wrote about me. If you don't believe what Moses wrote,
how will you believe my words? John 1:45, it says, Philip found Nathanael and told him, we have found the one who Moses wrote about in the law, and the prophets also wrote about, Jesus of Nazareth. And then you have Stephen in Acts 7:37. He says, this is Moses who said to the Israelites, God will raise up for you a prophet like me among your brothers. So this isn't, you know, this isn't me saying this. This is not my interpretation. Mm-hmm. This is a clear allusion from Peter, from Stephen, in the book of Acts, applying this verse to Jesus.
Okay, well, can I respond to that real quick?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so the problem here is all of what you've quoted from the New Testament is emphatically rejected by the Jews. They are not going to go and quote the New Testament to explain Deuteronomy 18:18. So that's a Christian, you could say, kind of a spin on it. But at the same time, there's problems. Even if we go to the New Testament and look at those passages, we will see that there are other verses which contradict, like John 1:21. But to wrap things up, because I actually have to get going, I think, Eric, here's what we can agree, and this is a question which needs to be answered by everybody. Why do Moses and Muhammad share this unique similarity? And I think going to the Bible and the New Testament, creating exclusion principles, trying to show dissimilarities, that doesn't answer the question. That doesn't answer why they share this unique similarity. And I don't think you have that answer tonight. And I can only come up with one answer, and that is he is that prophet. If you look for another explanation, it doesn't exist, unless you know one you can share for me, Eric.
Well, I cited several tonight, and, you know the thing is,
why they're similar, Eric. You're not understanding.
What's that now? Why are they similar? Why is it one is the both?
Okay, let me rephrase
why
it for you. I'm going to rephrase it. Let's pretend your exclusion principles all work. Let's pretend that there's a verse in the Bible which says that the prophets can only come from the Israelite lineage. Boom, that excludes Muhammad. Okay, fine, Eric. But that doesn't explain why do Moses and Muhammad share this unique similarities that no other people share. And I need an explanation from you why that is.
Similarities between I submitted over 10, 12 different similarities between Jesus and Moses that were not similar to Muhammad, and Muhammad didn't even
absolutely
come close to those. So, which
similarities
are you,
I accept. Eric, you're not answering the question, why is there similarity? Of course there's dissimilarities, of course.
What similarities are you talking about? Are you talking about that there were warrior prophets? Is that a similarity that you're referring to?
Yeah, so Eric, you see, my point here is trying to show dissimilarities is futile.
I'm just trying to figure out what similarities you're looking at here. They're lawgivers.
So here we see this warrior prophet coming with a law, victorious over his enemies, establishing a state, and making this great migration. Here we see this happening again. How do you explain these unique characters between Moses and Muhammad?
Was Moses successful over his enemies?
I believe so, yes.
Did he reconquer?
Oh, cool. That's how Israel was established, right?
Well, actually, it was established because Joshua went in and conquered the land. Moses was forbidden to go into the land because he sinned against God.
Well, he was like the head general guy, right?
No, that's what I was looking at. I didn't see it. You know, Nadir, I really have to go. And I'm sorry. We're going to have to continue this. This is a great discussion, and I love having guys like you on the program because – You don't try talking over me, and I try not to talk over you, and I appreciate that because I was talking to my producer one day about how can I get these conversations to flow better, and she says there's a second delay built into the program here, so when I start talking it is 3 seconds before you hear it and you can respond to it. So I have to run.
All right,
I'm going to go ahead and out the show. I really appreciate you coming on here this afternoon and giving us what you feel is Muhammad. How we find Muhammad in the Bible. Of course, I'm going to completely and adamantly disagree with that. But this is why it's. I think it's always a good thing to have a discourse like this. And I do appreciate you being cordial and respectful tonight.
Thanks so much for having me on your show.
Okay. Well,
hey,
so
when I'm in town, maybe we can hook up.
What, in Peoria?
Well, I might come out to Des Moines area or something like that. You never know. I'll look you up.
Well, I have your phone number. We might have to do something.
Okay. All right.
All right. You take care.
All right. Take a look. Bye.
All right. Bye now. Okay. Well, that went well, I think. Again, like I was saying, that this is something that I had not heard some of the arguments that he had made, and I think it's always fruitful to hear these things. I disagree with what Alandi said, and of course he's going to disagree with a lot of things that I said, but I think in the aggregate when we look at it, especially by applying some of those New Testament verses that I cited towards the end, that, oh man, Chris Claus, I forgot to ask your question. What a dolt. I'm sorry. Well, maybe next time when we get him on here. Okay, so again, folks, thank you for coming. I appreciate it so very much. Those people in the chat room, I see that Annie is still in the chat room. Thank you, Annie, for coming. Everybody bugged out. Evidently, Kel had a birthday party to go to. Who knows? All right. We will be back here next Sunday, same time, same channel. And I haven't really come up with what the topic is going to be next week, but we'll figure that out as we go along. God bless. Thanks for coming, everybody.
Deep-seated in the American citizen is pride in his community as an expression of all that his country stands for: individual independence, with respect for the rights of others, born of the concept that all men are free and equal.
Cut it short right there, folks. Thank you so much for coming tonight. We will see you all next week. God bless.